lower lip and looks me over.
Weren't you listening to me?
Yeah, I was. I just... She laughs at my inability to come up with anything.
Uh-huh. Sure. Are you all right?
That question again. Am I all right? Am I all right? Am I all right? Yes. Yes, I'm fucking all right. I know I am. I'm better than all right. I have hope now. I have hope that Teddy is just a few blocks from here. And all the rest of it doesn't matter. Yeah, I say. Yeah, totally, I'm fine. She studies me a little more, as though not convinced. Hey, I continue. Would you do me a favor? I've got to go check something out up on 46th Street for a second, when we get split up into groups. Do you mind covering for me if anyone asks where I am? She remains skeptical.
What are you doing?
I just gotta sneak away for a little bit to check something out. It won't take me long. Her eyes go narrow at me.
Yeah, sure. But what is it?
There is a moment where I almost tell her. It would be such a relief. Only I know I shouldn't. Jackie would worry just like Eliza would. She'd tell my parents and they would freak the fuck out. And then they'd all try to stop me. I'm sure Dr. Frankel would tell me I'm fucking crazy for even considering doing this, although he'd say it a whole lot more eloquently than that. But what he doesn't understand, and what nobody can possibly understand, is that this, doing this now, is the only chance at a sane, healthy life that I'm ever going to have. So even if this Tolliver guy is a psycho, pedophile, fucking lunatic, I have to face him. And I have to find out. I can't move on with my life until I do. I can't move on until I bring Teddy home. Then I will finally be able to start over. Telling Jackie is not an option. So instead I just say, nothing. It's a stupid errand I have to run.
During a school field trip?
I nod. Yeah, it'll only take a second. She brings her shoulders up and then lets them drop again.
All right, Mai. I'll try to cover for you.
Thanks. The chance for me to get away doesn't come until after we've already been given gloves and plastic bags and little grabber tools so we don't get stuck with hypodermic needles sifting through the sand. I bring my stuff up behind the public bathroom, not the same one I was in 2 years ago, I'm pretty sure, and try to hide it all as best I can behind the seagrass, growing tall out of the cracked concrete. I run fast across the great highway, dodging cars and not waiting for the light. No one calls after me. The sky is clearing, or at least, the sun is breaking through as the south winds blow the covering of clouds and fog farther inland. I put the hood of my jacket up over my head. Simon Tolliver's house is number 1921 46th Avenue, between Ortega and Pacheco Streets, just 3 blocks up from the beach. Honestly, it's not what I expected. I guess in my mind, I'd made the house up to be some creepy, run-down, dilapidated shack, with rusty tools lying everywhere, and taxidermy birds hung out front. But it's not like that at all. Actually, it's a super nice-looking little craftsman-style home, with a pretty vegetable garden in front, and a white picket fence surrounding the entire property. There is even a little trellised entranceway covered in purple morning glories, and rose bushes in a tangle around the side gate. It doesn't look like the secret hideout of a deranged kidnapper. But then again, maybe he keeps it nice for exactly that reason. A little house like this would be above suspicion. If he's smart, this is exactly the kind of place he'll live. And he must be smart if he's managed to evade the police for over 2 years. The buildings on either side of Tolliver's are bigger, two-story Victorian-style townhouses that are separated into upper and lower apartments, so it's impossible to tell whether anyone is at home to see me sneaking around. I decide the best thing to do is just march right up to Tolliver's front door and ring the bell. If he answers, I can always pretend I'm... what? Selling magazine subscriptions? Something like that. At least that way I'll know for sure whether he's home. So I let myself in to the front entranceway and take a deep breath, feeling my hands and legs start to shake. I walk jerkily past the planter boxes of squash and pumpkins, and then up the uneven white wooden steps. I press the buzzer and the doorbell sounds, echoing through the small house. A dog barks in the distance. I wait, holding my breath. But no one comes. The door remains closed. Walking then, slowly around the side of the house, I try to find a window I can see in through. But all the blinds are closed tight. Pressing my face up close to the clouded glass, I can just barely look into what turns out to be the bathroom. But that doesn't help me any. The bathroom is clean, and I can make out the shower curtain printed with a map of the world done up in different colors. Around the back of the house is a small yard bordered by a row of hedges at least 6 feet tall. There are patches of green grass, but it's mostly all dead, and the stairs leading down from the back sliding glass doors are all splintered and broken. There is also, in the far corner, tucked up between the hedges and a low-hanging eucalyptus tree, an 8-by-10-foot wooden shed, the roof covered in leaves and pine needles. The door is fastened shut with a lock, but the lock is left open. There is a dirty window smeared with something, built high up on the structure. I can see movement against the glass, flashes of light in the darkness. I imagine Teddy in there, tied up, gagged, trying to get free. The clouds are racing past overhead, so the shadows sweep across the yard and over the shed in the back, and I can feel my heart beating faster and faster in my chest, my whole body shaking badly so I have to hold my hands tightly together. I get up to the shed and look into the window, but it's so dirty I can't see anything. There is a noise, though, coming from inside, like newspapers being crumpled together and torn to pieces. "Hello?" I whisper, pressing my ear up to the crack in the door. "Hello?" Suddenly there is this feeling I get that someone is looking at me. I swing around and freeze. A dog, maybe 50 pounds, like some kind of border collie, is there, inching toward me, growling low and steady. "Hi, dog," I say dumbly. The dog growls louder, and I back up against the door of the shed. "Easy now. Easy." I get down on my knees on the damp ground. I avert my eyes and say, "Good dog. Nice. Good dog." Shaking, I extend my hand out so I can feel the dog's hot breath on the tips of my fingers. The growling stops. And then the dog's nose presses up cold on the back of my hand. "Jesus Christ," I say, standing up. I step back from the door, and the dog comes over and lets me pet it for a second. "Where the hell do you come from?" I ask. The dog then goes over to the shed and starts digging and pawing at the ground, whimpering. I take one last look around before grabbing the lock out of the door and opening it wide. "Hello?" I say loudly. The dog goes rushing in ahead of me. And then a whole shit ton of chickens goes flying and scattering back out. The dog barks and barks and goes chasing after them, getting one by the neck and shaking it, and I yell, "Fuck!" closing the door just so at least a few of the goddamn things don't get out. I manage to grab a particularly slow-moving chicken, but it pecks at me and squawks so loud I can't help but let it go again. The dog, content with its one dead chicken, goes running off, and it's at that exact moment that someone comes around the corner and screams, "Hey you! Stop! What are you doing?" I turn, startled. The man is wearing a hooded sweatshirt with the word Texas printed in orange letters across it. For some reason, that Texas is the only thing I can see. My eyes are fixated on it. And then he yells again. His accent is thick. "You! What are you doing here?" My mouth hangs open. I take a step back. My mind turns around, but comes up with nothing. "You stay right where you are. Don't move." "Tolliver," I say. "Simon Tolliver? I'm looking for Simon Tolliver." The man stops. "You knew him?" No, I stutter. The man drops his head. His whole body slumps over like something heavy is weighing him down. "Did he do something to you?" I realize then that the tears are still coming down, so I wipe my face and try to breathe, saying, "In a way, I'm sorry. he tells me. Then coming toward me with his head still bowed, he says, "This Tolliver, he was not a good man. We've been here a few months now. The realtor told us the story. It's very sad." My eyes go wide. "He's gone?" I manage to ask. "Do you know where?" "No. We bought the house from the bank." He clears his throat. "I'm sorry," he repeats. "It's okay. I'm okay." And then I turn. I turn and I run. The man doesn't call after me. He lets me go. 24. The fog is coming in fast off the ocean, and the wind has gone still. I take my jacket off and wrap it around my waist. The concrete sidewalk is all busted up from where the roots of trees have grown through, jutting out in places, nature fighting back against the oppressive onslaught of human development. I take out the picture of Simon Tolliver again and stare into his black-and-white photocopy eyes. "What the fuck do I do?" I ask him, waiting for an answer, but getting none. There's a liquor store on the corner with flashing beer signs in the window, and I go in to get a bottle of water and some peanut M&Ms, just 'cause I see the package and it looks good suddenly. The man behind the counter looks Korean, with a broad face and thick Coke bottle glasses. "Hey," I say, pulling out the photo, maybe for the last time. "Do you know this guy? He ever come in here?" The man looks lazily at the photo. "Oh yes, he come here," he says in broken English. "Friday he play lottery." My breath catches in my throat. "Every Friday?" He shakes his head. "No, he here last Friday. Lotto very big, 20 million. He only come when lotto very big." I thank him and walk out with the water and M&Ms. The fog is thick, so I can hardly see in front of me. I walk carefully back to the beach. That cool breeze is blowing through my mind. I'm getting close. I can feel it now. Closer and closer. Now it's only a matter of time. Till the jackpot gets big enough. Till I find Simon Tolliver. And Teddy most of all. 25. The sky is starting to clear, so I can see the half-pale moon on the horizon. I'm crossing Geary on the way back from having to work a couple hours at Cala Foods, because this other kid, Miguel, called in sick, when I get a text from Jackie, asking if she can come over. "Yeah, for sure," I text her back. And then I see that I have a missed call from Eliza. I press the phone to my ear and keep on walking up the street. Her voice is soft and beautiful through the electronic distortion. She asks me if I want to come over tomorrow night and have dinner with her. She repeats several times that she's cool with taking things slow. Of course, I'm not sure if I should go. I mean, I'm not sure if I should let myself. Finding Teddy is the most important thing. And I'm so close. I can't lose track of that. But I guess dinner couldn't hurt. Or, I don't know how it could. We can have dinner. And then when the jackpot's big enough, I'll go back to that liquor store and wait for Simon Tolliver. It's simple, really. And in this moment, it feels like everything might work out. So I cross down to Clement Street and walk up to our house. Jackie is already there, waiting on my front steps, bundled in her giant parka and big knee-high boots. "Miles, hey, I'm sorry." I can see she's been crying. Her eyes are red and swollen, but not from the cold. "Are you okay? What's going on?" She laughs, like it just bursts out of her. Then she hugs her knees to her chest and looks down at the concrete. "A fight," she says. "A fight. With Preston." I take out a cigarette and light it and sit down on the step. "I'm sorry. Am I bothering you?" "No, no, not at all. How long have you been here?" "Just like 10 minutes. She puts her head on my shoulder. She smells like incense. "What was the fight about?" I ask. "I don't know. Nothing. He's, well, does he seem different to you?" "Different?" There's yelling from across the street. and I look up to see two men arguing in front of the Vietnamese restaurant.
Yeah, different, Jackie says, ignoring the high-pitched shouting. Like, he's so into partying and stuff, and I know he's always kind of been that way, but it feels so much more now. Does that make any sense?
Sure, yeah.
I smoke and breathe in and out.
I'm sorry, she says,
taking her hat off and pulling back her long dreads.
I shouldn't be talking about this with you. He's your best friend. It puts you in a bad spot.
I laugh.
Oh, you're my best friend, too. I mean, sometimes I feel even closer to you than...
Yeah, me too, she says, cutting me off. I stare down at the scuff marks on my boots.
My therapist, I blurt out overly loud. He tells me this thing about how sensitivity is like a bell curve, you know, like we learned about in school. Basically, on one end is someone who's so sensitive they can't even function in the world. And on the other end is like a total sociopath, killer, whatever, who can't feel anything. Most people are in the middle, or around the middle. But me, I've always been way closer to the so goddamn sensitive I can barely function side. And I'm not saying you're like that, but you're definitely more sensitive than a lot of people. And you're a deep thinker, too.
She laughs then.
You don't think Preston is a deep thinker?
No, no, I tell her. It's not that. But he doesn't overthink things. And that's awesome. I wish I could be more like that.
I'm glad you're not.
She takes my hand in the warmth of hers. I swallow something down in my throat. And then my phone vibrates in my pocket. Jackie lets go of my hand, not that it means anything, and I check the screen. Again, of course. It's Eliza.
What's up with her?
Jackie asks, seeing the name on my caller ID.
Nothing. She wants me to come to dinner tomorrow night.
Is that a good thing?
Yeah, I guess.
You going to go?
I don't know. I'm not sure if I should. I've been trying to... Again, I want to tell her about Teddy. But I don't. I can't. I'm not sure I have time, I say, hoping that's vague enough.
Jackie kicks the heel of her boot into the concrete.
Have time? It's one night.
I see the way you are, always taking care of everyone. You should go have fun. Just do something you want to do.
I smile then and wonder if she's right. Or if I can even let myself.
What about you and Prez? Are you going to be all right?
Her eyes close and open.
Yeah, for sure. He's just going through... I don't even know. Maybe it's because we're coming up on senior year. And who knows what the hell will happen after high school.
I nod. Well, no offense to you or Preston, but I can't wait till we never have to see that place again.
She laughs.
Me neither.
I stand and feel a sudden coldness against my cheek.
Come on in, I say. You had dinner yet?
I help her up.
Thank you, she tells me.
We walk together inside. 26. It's around 10:30 when Jackie finally leaves. She stayed and ate dinner with us, and watched a couple episodes of Arrested Development on Netflix. My mom, of course, took a pill and went to bed. But me and Jackie and Jane and my dad all sat together laughing and eating ice cream. We would have kept on watching probably all night if we could have, but tomorrow's a school day and my dad made us turn it off. So Jackie gets in her mom's car and drives off. Then I say goodnight to my family and go quickly to my computer. I try to look up the California State Lottery, but for whatever reason, the page is taking forever to load. There must be something wrong with our internet. Anyway, I'm sure the lottery won't be big enough for Simon Tolliver to buy another ticket yet. That guy at the liquor store said it was just $20 million. Not that I'm 100% sure how the whole thing works. I'll have to look it up tomorrow. I turn the computer off and go to lie down on the bed. But then I hear my phone vibrating again on the table next to me. It's Preston. His name comes up on the caller ID. I roll my eyes. I mean, Jesus Christ. Like I'm some couples therapist?
I answer the phone and start pacing around my small room.
Yo, what's up?
His voice comes through strained.
Did you talk to Jackie?
Yeah, she just left here.
Oh.
There's a pause. Then,
is she okay?
Yeah, of course. Another pause.
Can I come over for a second, you think? Smoke a cigarette?
You don't smoke...
Come on,
he cuts in.
Please. I don't have anyone else to talk to about this stuff.
I nod my head, though obviously he can't see that.
Sure, yeah, no problem, I say.
He thanks me over and over. We hang up. It's funny, I guess. And I'm happy, too, that I'm able to be here for him, for both of them, as they've always been there for me, no matter what. So I put on my big jacket and a hat and a scarf and these fingerless gloves, because it really is cold outside. I have old-fashioned-looking plush slippers that used to be my dad's, so I put those on, too, and grab my pack of cigarettes. Out in the kitchen, my dad is up still, boiling water on the stove. He's wearing a bathrobe over flannel pajamas and drinking a glass of straight whiskey.
What's up, Tiger? Can't sleep?
I say to him, and he laughs.
That's right, old man. What about you?
He says. Preston called. He's coming over.
You're the marriage counselor tonight, huh?
That's just what I was thinking.
You want some hot chocolate?
He asks. I smile at him. His beard has grown in thick and long, so he almost looks like some hipster guy from the mission.
Is that what you're having?
He nods. The kettle starts to whistle on the stove, and my dad turns the flame off.
You're a good friend, he tells me.
And then my mom yells from their room,
Sam, what are you doing?
I guess maybe the kettle woke her up.
You better go on out, my dad whispers.
I do as he says. The night is very black and very cold. None of the streetlights are working, and the wind is still blowing in strong from across the bay. I smoke my cigarette and wait for Preston's little Fiat to pull up in front. He arrives about a minute later.
My man,
he says as we hug briefly. He smells, as always, like pot and incense. His ski jacket is zipped all the way up to his chin, and he has a wool hat pulled down low over his eyes.
It's fucking freezing.
I nod. Sorry, my mom's up, I tell him.
You mind if we sit out here?
Of course, yeah. That was the plan. He leans against the railing, and I crouch down on the balls of my feet.
Jackie said she came over here.
I scratch at the back of my neck.
Oh, so you talked to her?
He scratches at his broad chin with long, thick fingers, the nails wide and flat. Above him, a large crow flies down from the branches of a scraggly-looking beech tree. I blink my eyes to try to make it disappear. But it's still there, hovering in midair.
We texted, he says. What, you guys had dinner or something?
Yeah, we watched Arrested Development. She was upset. I blink again and watch as the crow swoops down lower. I tell myself it must be in my head. It has to be. It's the middle of the night. But then the crow flies up again. It flies up, and a giant glob of white crow shit goes splattering all over the shoulder of Preston's jacket.
Jesus, what the hell?
That bird took a shit on you, I say.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, what are the fucking chances? He laughs, and I laugh, and we laugh together.
Look, man, I say after a minute.
I get you coming over here. But Jackie loves you. Seriously, you don't have to worry. Preston crouches down next to me.
Really? She's okay?
I nod. Of course. She loves you. He smiles and plays with the zipper of his jacket.
It's that simple, huh?
It seems like it, yeah. Though obviously I don't know anything about relationships.
What?
Yeah, you do. I know about fucking them up. He spits over the railing.
What does that mean?
You know what it means.
Eliza?
That wasn't your fault.
My eyes close. No, that's not it.
Then what, man?
Nothing, I tell him. It's nothing.
He puts his hand on my shoulder.
Well, anyway, I appreciate you letting me come over like this.
Of course.
He smiles. I should probably hang out with Jackie tomorrow night. But maybe Saturday we can all go to a movie.
Are you gonna try to see Eliza?
I smile back.
Yeah, I guess I am.
He nods.
Well, be careful, okay?
You're probably sick of me saying it.
But be careful.
Thank you.
I will.
You better.
We hug and say goodbye, and he starts down the stairs. Sorry about that crow shit.
I call after him. He gets in the car and drives away.
27.
Eliza's family has moved into a new house since I knew her last, and from what I can tell from here at least, it's a lot smaller than I would have imagined. She points it out to me, a two-story townhouse at the top of the park at Alamo Square, a tiered park with a view of the entire downtown skyline and the Bay Bridge and the East Bay in the distance. We hike up the concrete steps that cut through the center of the park, passing the playground we used to play in together when we were kids. There's something so familiar being here with Eliza, and in a way it's like no time has passed at all. The sky is clear and cold, and the wind blows in strong off the ocean. As we walk through the park together, I look out and can see the reflection of the sun on the windows of the houses along the East Bay, like fire spreading. Eliza says nothing, but takes my hand in hers, and I feel her warmth against the wind and the cold. She has the hood of her sweatshirt up, covering her hair, and is wearing a heavy jacket over her sweatshirt, and those same torn jeans tucked into big lace-up boots. Her eyes are very blue against the black of her hair and the fading light. She leans forward then, and I realize she's trying to kiss me. And so I drop the backpacks and I kiss her, and she kisses me. And the feel of her against me makes me dizzy and lightheaded.
"This is me taking it slow,"
she says, her nose pressed against mine. I don't have it in me to fight her. Not when I've spent what feels like my whole life chasing after her. We kiss, our mouths and tongues together, and we breathe into each other. And it's like everything in my life has been leading up to this exact moment. It is all perfect. Part of some greater plan for me and for her and for the whole universe. We are kissing, and it is all beautiful and miraculous and exactly as it's supposed to be. Like there really is some divine will looking out for me. Looking out for us both. I put my hand on her tiny waist, beneath her jacket and sweatshirt and t-shirt, and feel her warm skin, and she shivers against me. I put my other hand on the small of her back, and she seems to fall into me. And I kiss her, and she kisses me, and I'm flushed and shaking, and then she pulls away, saying, "Come on, let's go inside." I kiss her again. "Come on, let me show you around inside." I pick up the two backpacks, mine and hers. She takes my hand. And now we walk together.
28.
Christina, Eliza's mom, is a pretty good chef, just like Eliza's dad, though she's not a professional or anything. She makes us these amazing-looking grilled cheese sandwiches and a salad with roasted corn cut off the cob and cherry tomatoes. She has black hair and green-blue eyes like Eliza's, though her features are much more narrow and petite. She wears a long, shapeless dress and a necklace with a jagged crystal hanging from the end. She's an old-school hippie. She always has been. She's into the whole organic, local food movement and everything. But like I said, her food is awesome. She puts the sandwiches down in front of us, and Eliza asks if I want a beer.
"You drink beer now?"
Christina asks me, and I hesitate before saying,
Yeah.
Mother and daughter exchange glances, and then they both smile.
"Well, what the hell?" Christina says. "I'll have one too."
She gets out three bottles of this apricot-flavored pyramid ale, and I feel very adult suddenly. We're all sitting together in their giant kitchen with brand new appliances and high ceilings, and it almost feels like me and Eliza are this grown-up couple in an apartment we live in together. The table is made up of mosaic tile, and the colors are vibrant. I realize I'm kind of staring when Christina says,
"It's good to see you, Miles. It's just like old times, no?"
"Cheers,"
She holds out the beer and we all cheers together. And I look over at Eliza and she's smiling back at me. By the way, Christina continues, we're going to Carmel for Christmas. I've rented a suite for the week. You really should come. Arrow, their one-year-old bloodhound, is currently positioned under my chair, trying to get whatever scraps of food I might be able to give him. He obviously assumes, since I'm the new guy, that I won't know the rules about no scraps from the table. And I guess he's right, because I sneak him a corner of my sandwich, and he slobbers all over my hand, eating it. Remember when we'd go up to Tahoe when you were kids? Christina asks me. That was such fun. Of course. I look over to Eliza to get her approval. Are you sure that would be all right if I come? Totally, she says cheerfully. Then it's settled. It'll be our treat. Christina drinks down more of her beer, and so I do too. Lycie's so happy to be back, she says. She's thrilled to see you again. I drop my head, blushing a little. It broke my heart to see you two leave on such bad terms. And I am so sorry to hear about all the trouble you've had. I nod my head slowly, breathing out. Yeah. It's not fair. This kind of thing always happens to the sweetest people. But you're in good company. Madness and genius are very closely related, you know. Yeah, right. I'm the last thing from a genius. Well, you are a sensitive soul. The world needs more people like you. Lord, compared to that Neanderthal Lycie was with in New Orleans. Mom! I see Eliza's face go flushed even more, and she has her eyes wide open like she's trying to communicate with her mom through facial expressions. I'm just saying, you are a major improvement. Eliza keeps on staring her mom down. Mom, please. Then she turns to me. She is right, though. You are an improvement. I fidget some. Gee, thanks. I guess. Eliza smiles now, and looks at me very sweetly. We look at each other for a few moments, just not saying anything. I have this intense urge inside of me to tell her I love her. I mean, I know that's crazy, since we haven't even really spent any time together in over 2 years. But then again, this whole thing is crazy. It all feels so meant to be, so natural, like some guiding force brought us back together. Oh, aren't you guys cute? Christina says, clasping her hands together. Eliza and I both blush and look down. It's perfect, she continues. Oh, Miles, by the way, I want you to write down your birthday and, most importantly, your birth time for me before you go. I want to do your charts, okay? You mean, like, astrology? I ask. Yeah, Eliza says, rolling her eyes. Mom's super into that these days. It is kind of cool, though. You'd be surprised how right on the readings are. Christina smiles. Well, of course they are. The planets control the tides, don't they? Human beings are 75% water. It makes perfect sense the planets would control us, too. I nod politely. Wow, yeah. I never thought of it that way. It'll be fun to see what it says about us, Eliza tells me. Christina leans forward on her elbows. She's wearing a cardigan sweater over her dress. And there's a strange brooch, like some kind of amulet, pinned over her breast. My guess is you two have been doing this for many lifetimes together, over and over. Otherwise, how could you have possibly found each other so young? Mom, please. I'm sorry, dear. You're right. It's not good to talk too much about these things. I do have a tendency to overanalyze everything. Are you spending the night, Miles? The question startles me a little. Then I choke, coughing. I mean, God, how I want to. And God, how I don't want to tell them the truth, that my mom would probably freak the fuck out if I asked her. She thinks me seeing Eliza again is going to mean me going batshit crazy again. Maybe hurting Jane this time like I hurt Teddy last time. But I do want to stay. I want to stay so badly. Everything here is just exactly the way it should be. I think about that Washington Phillips record. It seems so strangely coincidental that I would be listening to all this gospel music, and suddenly it's as if there really is a power like God in my life. There is that cool breeze blowing through my mind, and I feel as if there might actually be a power coming to take away all my pain and suffering, and the suffering of my family. I'm not sure how that's going to happen, but it is going to happen. I will be with Eliza, and I will find Teddy. My mom will be upset at first, but soon she'll come to see. She'll come to understand. I swallow and look up at Eliza. "I'd really like to," I say.
"Good," Christina says, "because you're welcome anytime. It feels good having a man around the house again, doesn't it, sweetie?"
Eliza smiles and blushes some more and shakes her head.
"Yeah, Mom. Jesus, that's enough, all right? Come on, Miles. You want to go outside?"
"Yeah, sure." I take my plate over to the sink, and then Eliza and I head out to the front porch to smoke. That breeze is there, cool and gentle and calming. I open the door. We both step outside.
29. The porch is painted a dark red color, and we sit on the top step. There is no one on the street, and no cars driving past.
"I'm sorry my mom is so intense,"
Eliza says, dragging on her cigarette.
"She means well."
I kiss the back of her neck and her lips, and she tastes like apricot beer and cigarettes. I wrap my arms around her and hold her close. The wind is blowing the fog in around us, so we are covered in this blanket of mist, and it grows ever thicker. We are alone in the middle of a dream. There is nothing but the fog and Eliza and me. And whether I say it or not, I know we are in love, that this is love, an ancient soul love that was given to us by a power greater than either one of us. We kiss and are lifted up together. The fog carries us away into the night. Nothing can touch us. We are sacred. We are chosen. Her body is pressed against mine, and it's like I can't get close enough, like I want to stitch my skin together with hers so we are together like this forever. I thank God. I say it out loud. Thank God. Her eyes sparkle in the damp. This is heaven. Right here and now.
30.
The sun streams in bright through the window in the morning, and I turn and see that she really is still there next to me. Eliza is there. I mean, she's here, sleeping, curled on her side, wearing a white tank top and underwear. It's very early still, and there are birds chirping loudly from the surrounding rooftops. Eliza seems to be sleeping heavily, but when I kiss her cheek, she blinks her eyes awake. All around us, the room is white and clean and perfect, and the bed is white and soft, and she leans forward to kiss me, and we kiss together, and she tastes clean and perfect, and I close my eyes and we kiss more. Her body is so soft and warm beneath my hands and beneath my body, and I kiss her all around her neck and shoulders. She makes little noises, and so I keep going and kiss down her body around the softness of her belly, and her hips jutting, and down the heat of her thighs. "Is this okay?" I whisper, and she whispers back.
"Yes."
"Are you sure?"
"Yes, yes,"
she says.
"I'm sure."
She seems so tiny underneath me, and I kiss her for what feels like hours, and the room fades out all around us, and the walls crash down, and it's like we are floating there. And then we make love, and it is more perfect and pure and incredible than anything I could have ever imagined or ever dreamed. When it is over, we lie together intertwined like that, and we breathe heavily, and then finally, finally, we fall back to sleep. Or I do, anyway. I fall asleep. Then I dream. I dream that I'm at the beach. At Ocean Beach. But the tide is so low, I have to walk for what seems like miles and miles to the water. The sun is bright and warm, like the day Teddy went missing. I walk out, trying to reach the ocean. And suddenly I see him, standing there with his back to me. His red hair is shaggy, and he's wearing those same floral pattern board shorts and the same loose-fitting t-shirt. He is walking toward the ocean, too, and I'm walking behind him, and I call out, Teddy! Hey, Teddy! But he doesn't answer or turn back toward me. I keep calling and calling. He won't turn around. He won't turn around or acknowledge me. And as I run to try to catch up, he just keeps getting farther and farther away, until finally he is in the ocean. I yell, Stop, Teddy, come back! Getting more and more frantic. It does no good. He disappears beneath the waves. I scream. Then all at once my legs begin sinking into the sand. The sand is like quicksand, pulling me under. I sink down to where my chest and lungs are compressed from the pressure of the entire beach closing in around me. I sink down. And then I hear it. The voice. The voice from the bathroom that day at the beach. The sound of it makes me want to pull my skin off and scream so there's nothing left inside me. Miles, it says, whispering, eating through my brain. Miles, stop. Stop fighting. This is what you want. No, I gasp. But then the sand covers me. I close my eyes and there is only this intense heat and this crushing feeling and I can't breathe. And then I jerk awake. It is late, I can tell right away. The afternoon sun warm and orange-colored. Eliza is still next to me, but there's this sick feeling in my stomach. I'm not sure why the hell her mom didn't wake us up for school. I stagger to the bathroom and run the faucet, and try to get the world to stop spinning. That voice from the dream is still there, whispering at the back of my mind. I thought it was the voice of some power, like God, guiding me toward Eliza. But it is the opposite of that. It was tricking me. It made me forget. It made me spend the night here instead of going home, like I should have, to be with my family. They need me. Teddy needs me. This with Eliza, it is a distraction. It's going to make me hurt the people I love. I lied to my mom and dad. I told them I was spending the night at Preston's. How could I have done that? I see it so clearly now. After everything I put them through, this is such a betrayal. My heart is beating fast now, so it's almost painful in my chest. I go back to Eliza's room and start putting my clothes on. What? Where are you going? She asks, sitting up. I have to get out of here, I say, my voice shaking. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have stayed. She pulls the covers up around her. What do you mean? Nothing. I'm sorry. It's me. It's my fault. This is all my fault. I'm sorry. Once I find him, once I make it right, then we can be together. But I shouldn't be here now. I can't believe this is happening, she says. But like she's talking more to herself, the sobs choking her, the tears coming down. I'm sorry. I put on my shoes then, fast, and start toward the door. Miles, wait! She calls. But I can't wait. I can't. I have to get out. I have to get out right now. And so I run down the stairs and out into the warmth of the afternoon sun. The wind has died down. The city is still and shimmering in the soft light. This was a mistake. But I will make it right. I will tell my family, and I will make it right. That voice is there whispering in my mind again. But it is different now. Stay away from her, it tells me. Stay away. It tells me that until I find Teddy, I can't have anything to do with her. Being with Eliza, that was a test. I almost got sucked in, drowned in the quicksand. But I got out. And now I'll go off to school, even if I'm late. And it will be all right. Soon I'll have Teddy back, and the voice will be silenced. And maybe then I will get to be with Eliza again. But for now that doesn't matter. Nothing does. Except for my family. Except for Teddy. 31. You what? My mom yells. You spent the night at Eliza's? And you missed more than half the day at school? She and my dad are standing there together. Were her parents there at least? My dad asks. Her mom was, yeah. The sun is low over the trees of the Presidio, and the house is all dark gray, covered in shadows.
Why did you lie to us, Mai?
My dad asks again. My mom cuts me off before I can answer.
What difference does it make why? He lied to us.
After everything. Jesus Christ.
Mom, I'm sorry.
I sit down on the couch then, and notice Jane watching us from her room. I say, I know I screwed up. I know it. But I'm gonna make it right. I promise.
How can you?
My mom yells.
You can't. You can't make it better. You lied to us. All we do is worry about you, and you lied to us. It's unforgivable.
My dad sits down on the couch next to me and puts a large hand on my shoulder.
No, no, it's okay.
No, it's not okay, my mom yells.
Sam, don't tell him it's okay. I'm sick of you always making me be the bad guy.
My dad sighs loudly.
Sweetie, that's not it.
He told us, didn't he?
He knows he shouldn't have lied.
But he did, my mom says. And then, turning to me,
you did lie. That's the point. It's unacceptable.
You're right, I tell her. Mom, you're right. I'm not arguing with you. And I'm so, so sorry. I promise you, I'll never do it again. My mom gets right in my face. There are tears in her eyes. And in mine, too.
Why should I believe you? How can I believe you?
I'm sorry, I say dumbly. She sits down next to me on the couch, buries her face in her hands, and cries and cries.
It's all right, my dad whispers, pinning his hand on her back. Please, sweetie, it's all right.
I'm sorry, I tell them both. I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. My mom continues to cry.
I just, she says through her tears, I can't take it.
Bringing my knees up to my chest, I rock back and forth slightly on the couch.
I'll make it up to you, I whisper,
more to myself than to them. And then louder, I'll make it better, I promise. I'll make it all better.
It's okay, my dad tells me. Why don't you go to your room for a little while?
I'll make it up to you, I say again.
Please, my dad repeats.
I stand up and walk to my room, and I leave them all where they are, better off without me. 32. It's an hour or so later when I go back out in the living room. My mom and dad and Jane are all watching some black and white movie on TV I can't place, but Jane gets up from the couch when she sees me and comes to give me a hug, and I kiss the top of her head.
Hush, my mom says. Come on, quiet. This is the good part.
She's referring to the movie, and I suddenly recognize it as To Kill a Mockingbird with Gregory Peck, the courtroom scene.
Sorry, I whisper.
Me and Jane go over to the couch, and I lie on the floor and watch the movie. And even though I know they're all mad at me, it's nice being here, home, with my family. Jane holds my hand as we watch. Gregory Peck gives a speech, and there's Scout, and I inhale the familiar smell of our house, along with the Christmas tree they must have put up after school yesterday while I was gone. It's scraggly and an off-color, with soft yellow lights and a few varied ornaments. My dad is on the couch with Mom, and he's sipping a drink and she's leaning against him. This is my family, and I love them more than anything. Curling on my side, I take my jacket off and cover myself like it's a blanket. There's a commercial now, and the local news anchor flashes on screen.
$95 million historic high for the lotto jackpot, more news at 11, he says.
The tears burn my eyes, and I cry softly. I cry because I'm happy. I'm going to make this right, I say aloud. My dad rubs my back with his big, calloused hand. I'll make it right, I swear. 33. The bus breaks suddenly, and I'm thrown forward into the hard plastic seat in front of me. A large man with a sunken, grizzled face turns and glares at me.
Sorry, I say.
He doesn't answer. The light is gray and dull through the scratched windows. I pick up my book off the floor and continue trying to read. My eyes can't focus, though. The words blur out, and I just keep thinking over and over how perfect this all is. Everything. My whole life, it has all been leading to this moment. Today. Right now. The bus rattles down the highway, becoming slowly more and more engulfed in the fog. In order to get down to Ocean Beach before work gets out, I did have to cut my last two classes, but when I come back with Teddy, I'm sure everyone will be quick to forgive me. Because I'm going to find Teddy. It will all come full circle. It's so clear to me. That voice is there like a gentle wind, telling me that I will find him. You're going to find him. You're going to make it all better. I get off the bus at the stop near the liquor store. The fog is thick and heavy, but it's still warm. The heat surges through me as my lungs expand and contract, and my hands shake badly trying to get a cigarette lit. The liquor store is just a block up, and I walk it slowly, going over and over the not very well-conceived plan I've put together. Not that it matters. I don't need a plan. The voice, the power will see me through this. But I do need to find a good spot to wait for Tolliver without drawing too much attention to myself. Everything is pretty empty, at least at the moment. 2:30 on a Friday afternoon. But I figure once school and work get out, there'll be more people. Besides the liquor store on the corner, there's a KFC catty corner, and an auto shop right next to it. Across the street is an old travel agency that looks like it's been closed since the 90s. Frisco Travel, that's what the sign reads. There's also a check cashing place next to that, and I watch a very slow-moving old man walk, bent and pained, out the swinging plate glass doors, through the fog, to a silver Buick sedan. A black-and-white cat with a bell on its neck darts quickly up the block and cuts through a side alley. I drag on my cigarette and keep my attention focused on the liquor store. A pickup truck, shiny and new-looking, pulls into the lot, and a very tall, very skinny man with big brown boots steps down onto the gray asphalt. It is not Simon Tolliver. I get ready to wait. The waiting seems to go on and on, but that wind blowing in my mind makes me feel at peace all through my body. I am exactly where I am supposed to be. I don't just believe that. I know that right down to the center of me. So I sit smoking and watching the entrance to the liquor store. Hours pass. I go inside once to buy a water, a Starbucks drink, and some of those pink and white animal cookies. The clerk is that same Korean guy, but he doesn't seem to recognize me. Outside, I eat the cookies and sit on the curb. The fog gets thicker and thicker as the sun begins to set, and the world turns dark around me. But still, I sit and wait. The time goes by, and then I see it. A white Ford Explorer. The same kind of car Dottie Peterson saw Teddy getting into. It pulls into the parking lot and the man gets out. There's no question. It is Simon Tolliver. He's tall and very thin, with a bald head and glasses. He wears a barn coat over a hooded sweatshirt, with his jeans tucked into knee-high rain boots. Dirt is splattered across his chest, and he's got on a pair of cracked leather gloves. Though, like I said, it's really not cold out. He walks with his head down into the store. "Now," the voice whispers. I run over to his car and try to find anything suspicious looking inside. I know I don't have a lot of time. My heart is beating fast, and my eyes can't seem to focus. I breathe. There are tools in the way back and a tarp. So quick as I can, without really thinking too much, I open the trunk and climb inside, slamming the door shut and crawling under the tarp. Almost instantly, I hear the front door open, and the man gets in. I hold my breath, waiting for him to find me, to throw the tarp back and murder me right there. But he doesn't. He starts the engine, and some twangy old-fashioned country music plays softly. I feel the car lurch backward and turn. Wherever the hell he's going, I'm going with him. There's no turning back now. I curl up tight and try to hold on to that voice. That cool breeze in my mind. That voice will tell me what's right. It will protect me. The car hits a bump and I slam against the back of the seat, and the tools rattle all around me. But as far as I can tell, Tolliver still doesn't know I'm here. I check my phone in my pocket then, to make sure it's on silent. There are 3 missed calls from my dad and 1 from Eliza. Obviously, I can't listen to them now.
My dad's probably worried about me, wondering where I am. Mom probably told him to call me. They'll both be really angry. But when they see I have Teddy, that I rescued him, of course they'll forgive me. I grab onto a very large rusted metal wrench to use as a weapon in case I need to fight my way out. The voice whispers softly to me that I am being taken care of, that it will not abandon me. And so I lie still.
34. We drive for a long, long time before the car finally pulls off onto what feels like a dirt road. I bump around in the back for a while, until finally the car comes to a complete stop, and Tolliver kills the engine and I hear the door open and slam. There's a steady sound of crickets chirping. I pull back the tarp. The night is dark. Only the light from a little farmhouse illuminates the field of artichoke and burned-out tractor parts scattered everywhere. Crawling over to the back seat, I switch the overhead light so it won't come on. Then I open the door and climb out, easing the door shut behind me. From what I can see, I must be on a working farm up on the cliffs. There's heavy fog and the sound of an owl in the distance. Running hunched and low, I creep around the side of the house. There's a woodpile built up next to one of the windows, so I climb up and try to see in through the drawn curtains. All I get is the corner of maybe the living room. There's a hardwood floor and a yellowed wall, but that's all I can make out. And then there's a shadow and the voice of a little boy, around 10 years old.
No, no, he calls out.
Tolliver stumbles into the room and grabs hold of him.
Come on, it's okay.
He carries the boy back, and for a moment I can see the two of them perfectly silhouetted. Tears come to my eyes and I take a deep breath. It is Teddy. I thank God. It is Teddy, and I found him, and everything is going to be all right. I reach into my pocket to get my phone to call the police. But my phone isn't there, and I realize it must have fallen out in the car somewhere. I run back and begin rummaging around amongst all the tools and things. The phone is there, and I open it frantically. But there's no signal way out here on this farm. I can't believe I'm even thinking this, but the only thing to do is go in there myself. So I grab that same rusted wrench and hold it tightly in my hand. I start toward the house, breathing heavily. But then there is a light coming from over the dirt road in the distance, and I watch, open-mouthed, as the light gets closer. Another car. It's almost right on top of me before I can move, but I do. I move, running behind the corner of the house, crouching down low. The car is a black sedan, and a man walks out quickly, wearing a big coat, carrying a black leather-looking bag. He goes to the front door and knocks. Tolliver lets him in a second later. I climb back up on the woodpile and wait. The man that's come in has a really low voice, and I hear him shouting,
"Hold him down. Hold him down there."
My throat swells, and I feel the adrenaline surge through me, rushing straight to my brain. I climb down. I hold the wrench tightly in my hand and run round to the front door. I grab hold of the door handle and pull it open. There's a strange musky smell in the house, and it's dimly lit. The sound of voices comes from my left, and I take a deep breath and run headlong into the room. I have the wrench raised up over my head. I can't even hear because my heart is beating so fucking loud. I shake and scream and run in and feel heat all through my body.
"Let him go! Let him go!"
I yell as loud as I can. Tolliver turns first and grabs my wrist, and his hand is fucking strong, and he shakes my arm so the wrench falls, and then I swing my other hand and hit him in the face.
"Oh, what the hell?"
he shouts. The other man, with a deep voice and dark features, grabs me from behind and throws me on the ground. I hit the hardwood floor and sit up, and then I look over on the couch and see Teddy is there, with a cloth on his head. I try to stand up, but the deep voice man pushes me down again.
"Call the police," he yells to Tolliver. "I'll hold him here."
"No, I'll call the police," I yell louder. "Teddy, Teddy, it's me!"
The deep voiced man leans over me, pinning my arms back.
"Stop it. Who are you? What are you talking about?"
Then Teddy shrieks and vomits on the rug next to me. Tolliver comes running to help Teddy up.
"Christ, Doc, he's so sick. You gotta help him."
The man he called Doc looks up at Tolliver, carrying Teddy.
"What about this kid?"
"I'll take care of him. Here, help me." Teddy cries again. Then he throws up all over his t-shirt.
Jesus,
I say.
Teddy, what did you do to him?